Please be seated. What a wonderful turnout. Welcome everyone, and especially our alumni who appear to have turned out in droves. I see a lot of old friends here. Anyway, welcome. Tonight, it's my honor and very great pleasure to welcome Mr. William Kowalski back to his old home at St. John's. And since Mr. Kowalski graduated in 1994, he's led an illustrious life as a writer. What an adventure that must have been. And he's written numerous novels, the best known of them, I'm sure many of you know already, Eddie's Bastard, which about a couple of years ago, an article in the English newspaper, The Guardian, described as a neglected classic of modern American literature. And I would agree. If you haven't read it, read it. However, I know that writers also hate to be known only for their first book. And Mr. Kowalski has written many other books that I urge you to read, especially his latest one, The Best Polish Restaurant in Buffalo. It's a wonderful book. It's really quite an exceptional opportunity to have Mr. Kowalski here, because he's a writer who's known for his skillful storytelling. As you know, he's a master craftsman of plots, and I personally find that one of the things that distinguishes his novels is that they're enthralling because of the skill in narrative, but also unlike probably most good modern novelists, Mr. Kowalski has a kind of generosity of spirit. You know, there's an innocence and sweetness to his writing. He likes people. That's rare in a writer. Right? Yeah, people who like people don't usually become writers. So that comes across in his novels. Get Eddie's Bastard. Get Best Restaurant in Buffalo and any other of his novels. And see, I'm putting in a free plug for him here. But these books are very difficult to dislike. I dare you to try. Okay. So, but the topic tonight is Aristotle's Poetics. And at this college, even though we study numerous works of narrative fiction, and even though Aristotle himself says that plot is the very soul of tragedy, we are usually so preoccupied in the philosophical provocations of the text that we read that we hardly ever get the chance to discuss what it means to craft a plot, what the making of a story entails. So tonight, I think it's a rare privilege and opportunity for us to think about this. Now, after the lecture, there's going to be a 10-minute break where you can refresh yourselves and eat cookies and chat and make new friends and talk to old friends and so on. Only 10 minutes though, because then we're going to convene in the next room, the junior common room, for a discussion period. And the discussion period is the best part. So we hope you can attend that. So please welcome Mr. William Kowalski.
Thank you. Thank you. Firstly, I just wanted to say that I'm very grateful to be here this evening with you all on the happy and rather astonishing occasion of the 25th anniversary of the commencement of the class of 1994. It's a huge honor for me to be asked to talk with you, because I am keenly aware of how many very intelligent people have stood here before me to share their view of things. Thank you to the college, to President Roosevelt, to Dean Sterling, to Paul Cooley for his assistance in accommodating my wife and myself, and especially to David Carl and Krishnan Venkatesh, aka the Iron Bookworm, for asking me to come be here with you this weekend. I want to let you know ahead of time, this is really not going to be a proper lecture, largely because I am not a proper academic. Nor an academic at all, actually, and I am certainly not an expert on Aristotle or his poetics. I've given a lot of talks and a lot of readings, but never a lecture. So I feel the pressure to be on to be not just witty and urbane and insightful, but scholarly, which is a bit of a stretch for me. But mostly what I hope to accomplish this evening is to help you understand what writing creatively in Aristotle's time has in common with writing creatively in our time, and to explore what we can learn from his interpretation of this rather peculiar art form. I say peculiar because my obsession with writing stories about things that never happened, in order to have an emotional impact on people I'll never meet, has never made much sense to me. Only very recently have I had a series of insights that have illuminated what writing fiction might actually be about for me. I don't know what it's about for you. I hesitate to say anything about your experience. I can only talk about mine. Even if it does turn out we have a great deal in common when it comes to our reasons for writing, all the same, generalizing will not help any of us, and that's important to note because that's my other goal this evening, to help you, or at least those of you who love to write or think you might someday, and who are looking for insights that will help you speed your development. Poetics is part of our cultural heritage, for better or worse, and as such, it belongs to everybody. So if you will allow me to play Socratic midwife for the next hour, perhaps I can show you there are a number of things you already know about writing without realizing you know them, much like the slave boy in Mino who was shown he already understood basic principles of geometry despite his total lack of education. And perhaps I can also teach you one or two new things that you can then take away and incorporate into your own writing practice. And if you're not a writer, maybe my perspective on Aristotle's work will at least provide you with a few new things to think about. A couple notes on my experience. I came to St. John's after a year spent in the creative writing program at Emerson College in Boston in the late 1980s. During the time I was here, something strange happened. My compulsion to write fiction, which had accompanied me from the age of about 6, completely disappeared. For 4 years, I didn't even try to write. I couldn't think about it. It seemed silly, and so far away from the work we were doing that I just couldn't switch gears. I didn't even talk about it with anybody. When I published my first book in 1999, 5 years after I graduated, a number of my Johnny friends expressed surprise. They didn't know I was interested in writing because I'd never told them. I think what happened was that my energy was completely consumed by the program, even as it was working on me from the inside, forcing me to examine and re-examine all those things I thought I knew and to admit that I really didn't know much of anything. And yet, over the next couple of years, the compulsion returned, as compulsions are wont to do when left untreated by a competent psychiatrist. In 1995, I began pecking away at a short story that would eventually turn into the draft of a novel, and then I kept pecking away at that draft until it had become Eddie's Bastard, which, to my amazement, was published by HarperCollins the year I turned 29. I want to stress here that despite my lifelong interest in writing, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. When I look back at the success that book achieved and realize, knowing what I know now, what an incredible series of odds had to be overcome in order for all that to happen, I am astonished at the hubris my younger self showed. Maybe hubris isn't the right word, maybe blissful ignorance is better. I succeeded in writing an international bestseller because I didn't know I couldn't. The beauty and the greatness of the works we studied here and the encouragement we received from our tutors and the rarefied atmosphere of this ivory tower in the desert, and the unfettered brilliance of my classmates, many of whom were already true intellectual giants, whose abilities far outweighed mine, all combined to convince me I was entirely capable of pulling something like that off. I want to avoid giving the impression that Aristotle should be held up as some sort of paradigm. It was incorrect of me to say in my introduction that he wrote Poetics as an instruction manual. Mr. Venkatesh has pointed out in private correspondence that it was really intended to be more of a quick study of a relatively new phenomenon. Also, the deeper I dig into Poetics, the more put off I become by certain of his beliefs and attitudes and opinions. For example, Aristotle had no moral qualms whatsoever with slavery, and he firmly believed that women were the inferiors of men. I feel these facts need to be acknowledged. Some of the things Aristotle says are damaging and wrong. Nevertheless, I continue to be struck upon rereading Poetics by how timeless some of his advice is thousands of years later. How is that possible? The novel did not exist in ancient Greece, so when Aristotle gave advice to writers, he was addressing himself to writers of drama, who he called poets. In those days, writers were more than what writers are today, and more than playwrights, too. They also had to write music and compose choreography, or at least collaborate with people who did, because they were writing for the stage. It's not clear to me from Poetics that Aristotle had a deep understanding of how to create music or dance. He seemed more concerned with the effect these things are supposed to have than how to create them. But he understood the importance of a simple story well told, and he attempted to impart this and other lessons, which he did very effectively. It's remarkable to me that he arrived at these guidelines because, as far as we know, Aristotle himself was not an author of drama. His writing was of the kind for which we know him today, analytical, exhaustively detailed, filled with observations and conclusions, and spanning disciplines with an effortlessness that inspires awe. He wrote about writing the same way he wrote about the development of chick embryos, through long, careful observation, undertaken through the lens of his time and place, and powered by his unparalleled, if sometimes mistaken and misled, intellect. However, it's also noticeable, to me at least, that Aristotle wrote about writing the way critics do and not the way writers do. What I mean by this is that critics are famous, among writers at least, for often complaining about all the things a story isn't. They say this or that should have happened or happened differently. In Aristotle's case, he laid his guidelines out mostly in the form of positives rather than negatives, thou shalt's rather than thou shalt not's, but all the same, in Poetics, he touched not at all upon the things that writers usually talk about today, which is to say word choice, dialogue, the monotony of sitting down at your keyboard every morning with a cup of coffee only to spend an hour staring at the wall, all the nitty-gritty details of writing. He did delve more deeply into this in Rhetoric, a work I won't touch on tonight. The writer's frequent lament about critics is that though they may understand the cultural context of a novel better than most, few of them really seem to understand what goes into writing one. Of course, writers are loath to complain about this in public because it makes us sound like whiners. I feel safe saying this because I'm also a critic. Let's talk about how it's even possible that anything we say about writing drama might also be true of writing novels. What do modern drama and modern fiction have in common? It's more than just the act of writing. As it turns out, they are cousins with a common ancestor. The modern novel is a descendant of the Greek drama, but more than that, it really is a distillation, actually the fifth distillation, the quintessence, of something even more primal and basic than that, and that is conflict. Novels are a fight to the death, greatly purified, ritualized, stylized, and otherwise transformed as to be mostly unrecognizable as such. To be more precise, they're a depiction of a fight to the death, of course, often in metaphorical terms. As an aside, I can tell you that from the writer's perspective, the act of getting the damn thing onto paper often feels like a fight to the death every time, and for about 98% of that time, you may feel like you're on the losing end. So what am I talking about when I say a fight to the death? It is possible to trace the development of poetry in the original sense of the word, which we're going to explore shortly, from the fight for survival in the jungles and savannas of primordial times all the way to the glowing digital page on your Kindle today. Our earliest battles were against wild animals and each other. Very early in our development, it must have been the case that we began to prize feats of physical strength and violent prowess, for he who could smash the most heads could do the best job at ensuring survival for his tribe and of passing on his DNA. For most of humanity's existence, this was among our most prized traits. It seems to me now, as an observer of our society, that we are coming to prize other traits, which I think is a very good thing. We are, without doubt, undergoing a societal shift that is leading us in the direction of the dissolution of the patriarchy, the celebration of other values besides head smashing. What effect is that going to have on the fiction of the future? I'm going to leave that question hanging, but I will ask you to ask it of yourself. We know that contests of strength became ritualized over time, ultimately reaching a refined state in public games such as the Olympics, which involved demonstrations of skills that had their birth in war, wrestling, javelin throwing, chariot racing, etc. The first Olympic Games were held nearly 800 years before the Common Era, that is about 3,000 years ago. The first Greek dramas that we know of appeared about 200 years later. Of course, correlation does not equal causation. Just because drama appeared after the games doesn't mean the games caused drama to come into being. So why would I bother to point this out? Because of a very simple rule that I and every other successful professional writer, be it of books, movies, or TV shows, exploit on a regular basis. Humans are drawn to watch conflict. We can't help it. It's in our DNA. And it is conflict that is the essence of entertainment. Even postmodernist authors Don DeLillo and George Saunders, were you to ask them, would describe their fictional characters according to their role in the conflict of the story. The protagonist or hero is the first actor, while the antagonist is the one who struggles against him. That's how central conflict is to storytelling. If you're describing a struggle, you're going to get an audience. But conflict doesn't necessarily mean violence. That is just the basest form of conflict. Watching two burly guys tear each other to shreds satisfies the tastes of some, but for more discerning audiences, it's distasteful and even nauseating. So don't just think of conflict as violence. Think of it as struggle. A young person trying to find the courage to tell his parents he's gay, a couple arguing in a restaurant, a woman walking across a tightrope 50 feet in the air. All these scenes depict people in the midst of a struggle. By our very nature, we cannot look away. We are conditioned to ask, and then what happened? Is she going to make it? Who is going to win? Even though we're just spectators, our fight or flight response is engaged. And conflict isn't always good versus evil either. Sometimes the most interesting conflict is between good versus good, one kind of right versus another. The job of the writer is to harness this natural human urge to observe conflict and to make it work in his favor. If you're writing something that you feel isn't working, but you don't know why not, ask yourself, is there enough conflict in this story? Have I laid the groundwork for my readers to feel an emotional investment in the outcome? With the development of the staged drama, there was yet another deeper way of exploring the emotion that conflict arouses in us without physical prowess as a limiting factor. So we, as a culture, as a species, went from staged fights to the death or the mock death, to staged dramas, to novels as a form of drama that doesn't require a stage, and which offered people the chance to become readers instead of attendees, to become participants in the story in a whole new way. Any introductory discussion of this work needs to include an exploration of the title. Poetics, or the word poetry, comes to us from the word poiesis. This is derived from the word poiein, which means to make. Poiesis means the activity in which a person brings something into being that did not exist before. If this were a seminar, it's easy to imagine we could spend the entire 2 hours taking this definition apart word by word, trying to understand why it specifies the activity in which a person brings something into being, and not, for example, the thing itself, or the thought process that goes into making it, or what it means to make something that didn't exist before, and how such a thing is possible, and where the raw materials for this thing, whatever it is, might have come from, and at what point did they cease to be individual elements and instead become the thing we made. Our modern definition of the word poetry, which includes types of meter and rhythm and rhyme schemes and lots of other things, and is actually a rather fluid and powerful word, still doesn't even begin to cover the original meaning. The concept of poiesis may seem beautiful, and in many ways it is, but there is also something agonizing about it. I think of poiesis as applying particularly to the first draft of a work, which is the most painful part of the writing process for me, and often the most confusing. When writing a first draft, I'm not shaping a block of marble into a sculpture. I'm creating the block of marble out of nothing. I am making my own raw material. Why am I doing this to myself again, I will think, as I sit down to begin typing out yet another first line. What is my issue? What did my parents do to me that was so horrible? I must spend the rest of my life crying out my pain on the page. Actually, they didn't do anything to me. I'm just a neurotic. So Aristotle didn't title this work Poetics only because it deals with what we today consider poetry, though it did include that since ancient Greek plays were in verse, but because it involves the creation of an entirely new thing that didn't exist before. Of course, this way of looking at the word seems to deny the notion that every work of art is somehow rooted in the works that came before it, that played a role in influencing it. Nothing comes out of nothing. Everything we tell ourselves is new has actually come out of something before it. Some echo of the original sense of poiesis lingers in modern English when we describe someone's writing or speech as poetic. We don't just mean that it rhymes, but we find it beautiful or artistic, a combination of both techne and poiesis, skill and art. But we don't often use the word to describe anything other than language, which seems to me a loss. We don't frequently use it to talk about physical objects, for example, or if we do, people look at us funny. We still respond to phrases like poetry in motion, or we might understand when someone refers to a really well-designed object as poetic, because on some deep unspoken level, perhaps archetypal, we still understand that the creation of anything is the creation of a poem, if we take the word poem, which of course also comes from poiein, to refer to the thing that was made through poiesis, a play, a painting, a house, a child, a relationship, an idea, a feeling we've never had before. All these things are poems. Poetry is everywhere. You are a poem. Let's get a bit more literal now and talk about types of poems. Aristotle tells us there are three main categories: comedies, epics, and tragedies. He tells us that comedy originated in Sicily, of all places. We don't tend to think of Sicily as a particularly amusing place these days, or at least I don't. Perhaps a lot has changed. He also says that comedy is funny because it is a representation of people who are inferior but not vicious. I found this definition confusing at first. I had never thought of comic actors as representing inferior people, but then I was raised in a society that prided itself on its egalitarianism, or at least the appearance of it, and it was not in my lexicon to classify people as superior or inferior because I was taught that it was wrong to do so. Viciousness, meanwhile, was not something that would naturally have entered my mind in a discussion on comedy. Is something funny because it isn't vicious? Well, no. I have trained myself as a writer not to say what things aren't, but to say what things are. It's not enough for me to say that someone is funny because he isn't causing true pain, but this isn't a lecture on comedy, so I'm not going to go too far down that rabbit hole. In modern literature, one of my favorite comic works is John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces, which features the hypochondriac Ignatius J. Riley, whose pyloric valve is a constant source of anxiety and whose inferiority shows in his resentment of his own unrecognized brilliance, as well as his disdain for nearly everything modern. Ignatius is pathetic, seeing himself as the constant victim of the goddess Fortuna, but he is never physically vicious. If you want to read a great example of an American comic novel, this is the one I would recommend to start with. Comedy, however, is not a common type of novel. I don't mean to say there aren't many, because there are, and some of them are very funny. But of all the novelists I've met and read, I would say fully 99% of them have not even considered writing what Aristotle might consider a comic novel. Frankly, I think we need more of them. The second type of story is the epic. Aristotle tells us that epics, like tragedies, deal with superior subjects rather than inferior ones. The epic also uses what he calls the narrative mode. While tragedies generally deal with events as they occur over a single day, an epic is unrestricted in time. Aristotle says that all of the elements of the epic are present in tragedies, though the reverse, he says, is not true. So what is this narrative mode? Mode here refers to the method by which the poetry is conveyed to the audience. Tragedy is conveyed by another type of mode called drama, that is, dialogue and movement. The narrative mode is conveyed by a single storyteller, a rhapsode. Many novels incorporate this mode. We might think of the storyteller as being the omniscient narrator, except that in the epic poem, the storyteller can also assume the voice of some of the characters. The Iliad is the epic that every incoming freshman at St. John's first encounters. Aristotle says that he considered the tragedy to be superior to the epic for a number of reasons. Tragedies, for him, seem to pack a greater emotional wallop since they took place in a shorter narrative time frame. So I think most modern novels can be safely said to contain elements of epics and sometimes comedies, but for the most part, they veer toward the tragic. Again, I believe this is because tragedies necessarily deal with, to use Aristotle's term, superior subjects. As an aside, I have to recommend Dorothy Sayers' wonderful lecture, which she delivered at Oxford in 1935, and which is now available as an essay called Aristotle on Detective Fiction. Sayers shows clearly that the modern detective story relies on all the techniques that Aristotle noticed and commented upon. She goes on to claim, perhaps a bit tongue-in-cheek, but mostly seriously, that he was not so much a student of his own literature as a prophet of the future, who desired in his heart of hearts a good detective story. She deduces this from his, quote, stout appetite for the gruesome, unquote. His insistence that plot is the most important element of any story, and his simplistic yet undeniably profound observation that, quote, it is possible to discover whether someone has or has not done something, unquote. Indeed, Sayers boldly claims that tragedy was the form the detective story took in Aristotle's day, and I can find little cause to refute her. Now that we've examined the basic types of stories, let's look at the elements of them the way Aristotle broke them down. This, to me, is the really interesting part of poetics, and for the modern writer, the most valuable, in my opinion. But first, I want to introduce a fictitious story that is not just a work of fiction, but a work of fiction that doesn't actually exist. This is a story I call Zog and the Mammoth, and I use it to make certain points about storytelling when I'm talking about the art of writing fiction. The plot of this story is very simple, which Aristotle would have approved of, by the way. A young hunter named Zog goes mammoth hunting, kills a mammoth, and comes back to tell the story of the hunt to his tribe. But this isn't a story about Zog. It's actually a story about Zog telling his own story to his tribe after he returns from the hunt. This is one of the oldest and most basic forms of storytelling there is, but the reason it's worth examining is because it breaks storytelling down into its most basic forms. So, we're back in prehistoric times now, part of a group of people who are living just after the last ice age, somewhere in southern Europe, say. Zog, a young hunter, is just back from a successful trip in which he managed to kill a mammoth and bring the meat back. That's a big deal, because it means the continued survival of his people, at least for another season. Now he's sitting around the fire with the rest of his tribe, including people of all ages, their children, his friends, their children, their parents, maybe even their grandparents. Zog is gearing up to tell the tale of how he speared the mammoth. Everyone is rapt, and he's loving the attention. The last thing he's going to do is say, well, I saw a mammoth and I killed it, the end. Good storytellers know that storytelling is a striptease. He wants to entertain everyone. He wants them to know how brave he was and how scary the whole situation was. He wants them to respect his knowledge of hunting craft. Maybe he wants to capture the attention of the single ladies of the tribe. Maybe he's secretly hoping that his story will be memorialized in a painting on a cave wall. And he wants to educate the younger hunters who are absorbing every single word he says with total attention, partly because they idolize Zog, and partly because what he has to say might save their lives someday. He begins by describing where he was, including the place and time. I was far away by the big rock at the time of the long shadows, he might say. That's the setting. He might describe how he got there, who he was with, and how long it took him to get there. He might detour into telling one or two smaller stories about things that happened to him along the way, such as a meeting he had with a person from another tribe, a sighting of a strange new animal, a weird new plant he found, or any other item of note. He's not just throwing these details in as filler. They will be heard and memorized by everyone who is listening because it adds to their collective wisdom and deepens their understanding of the world, making it just a tiny bit more likely that they will survive. If his destination was somewhere the other tribespeople have never been before, he will take extra care in describing it, because they will add this knowledge also to their tribal memory banks, forever after remembering it as the place where Zog killed the mammoth. That way, if they ever find themselves in the same place, they'll be able to recognize it, even though they've never been there before. You can start to see why, from an evolutionary perspective, the ability to tell stories is a huge advantage. We can safely say that Zog has left the beginning of his story and entered the middle when he begins to talk about actually picking up on the trail of the mammoth. In terms of story architecture, he's traveling up the arc. Tension is building. His listeners are engrossed and getting excited. Maybe he's been observing a herd for several days, watching them to understand their behavior and trying to find a likely ambush spot. Maybe he intends to start a stampede and make them all run over a cliff. Maybe he found some mammoth tracks and followed them for a long time. All this would form the middle of the story. If Zog is a particularly good storyteller, he will stretch the middle out, building anticipation in the minds of his listeners. He will try to make the eyes of the little ones widen in fear as he describes the size and the smell and the sound of the mammoth when he finally spots it. He will try to impress his comrades with his skill in sneaking up on the herd without being detected. He will brag about his bravery and his physical prowess, but he can't overdo it in this department, or the others will make fun of him, the perennial curse of the dude who tries too hard. He will also crave the approval of the elders, who may have been through similar experiences themselves and who, though well past their prime, can still influence the way other members of the tribe see Zog by how much respect they decide to show him. Finally, Zog will arrive at the moment where he throws the spear. He will devote some care to this part of the story too, for this is obviously the climax of the tale, the whole reason he went hunting in the first place. He'll try to describe how it felt to see the mammoth react to the blow, and whether it charged him or took off running. He might try to stretch things a bit and claim that it fell dead instantly, but here he risks losing credulity, and besides, the longer he can spin things out, the better. He will describe the death throes of the massive beast. If he was injured in the hunt, that will only serve to make the climax that much more exciting, since it was completed against greater odds than expected. Finally, when the mammoth is dead and Zog stands next to his body, victorious, the climax may be said to be complete. Everything that happens after this properly belongs to what we call the ending. We almost don't even need to hear it, because it's obvious to the tribe what happened. Zog killed the mammoth and brought it home. But no tale would be complete without an ending. Endings allow time for our brains to snap back into place after having been transported. They allow us to process and correctly categorize the information we took in. They allow us to unwind emotionally and to perhaps exhale all the tension and fear we had been holding in as we listened. It is a catharsis, the release of strong emotion. As a writer, you have an obligation to create that catharsis because you are the one who created the emotion that made it necessary. Now, let's look at the story of Zog in Aristotelian terms. Aristotle tells us that stories are made up of five elements: setting, character, plot, dialogue, and thought. He also included a category for melody, which dealt with the music that accompanied drama in his time, but I'm leaving that out because it's not relevant to our discussion. We understand setting. This is time and place. When Zog is telling his story, he's going to begin with the setting, simply so that his audience will feel rooted in the narrative. In thought, we can include a character's motivation or intention. This is important because we must be able to empathize or feel along with at least one major character in a story. Thought, as Aristotle uses it, actually goes much deeper than that. It seems to me to approach the word spirit. Empathy runs much deeper than sympathy. We cannot feel it unless we have a clear understanding of what a character wants, which in turn leads to an understanding of why the story is happening. This needn't be complicated. In fact, it's far better if it's not. Zog went hunting because his people were hungry and they were going to die if he didn't bring them food. Anyone can follow that. Kurt Vonnegut famously said, "Your character should always want something, even if it's just a glass of water." So your character's thought will be about assuaging her thirst. The thing that prevents her from getting that glass of water is the conflict inherent in the story, and the tale of how she moves through that conflict and gets the glass of water is your plot. Aristotle believed that plot was everything. The first essential, the life and soul, so to speak, of a story is the plot, he wrote. People have paid vast sums at workshops to be told what this son of a Thracian doctor has been trying to tell us for free all this time. We can forgive a good story badly told, but we will never forgive a bad story wrapped in flowery prose. The perfect plot is simple, not complex. The plot should be so framed that even without seeing the things take place, he who simply hears the account of them shall be filled with emotion at the incidents, Aristotle tells us. Stop and think for a moment of your favorite novels or movies. How easy is it for you to explain to someone else what they're about? Most likely your answer is very. From the perspective of a writer, the ability to explain your plot in a few lines, the famous elevator pitch, is usually one key indicator of the engagement factor of the story. As my own editor at HarperCollins, the late Marjorie Braman, told me many times, if you can't explain the gist of your story in two or three sentences at most, it's probably not ready yet. I have found that new writers tend to require a bit of convincing that the plot of their story should receive editorial attention before anything else. For many years, I worked as a private editor, and I always began my critiques with an examination of the plot of the story. It seemed to me many of my clients were unprepared for that. I will confess that I myself was not always ready to hear that the subject matter I'd chosen for a particular story was not yet up to snuff. Writers often feel an almost parental affection for the stories they've decided to tell, but they may not yet understand that as professionals, they must put their own desires last and instead consider what their readers might prefer to read. This, in fact, is one of the clearest distinctions between the amateur and the professional writer. The amateur writes for herself alone. The professional writes for her readers. There is absolutely nothing wrong with writing for your own enjoyment. It is the best reason to write. But if you want to make a living at it, that's a different story. After plot, Aristotle tells us, characters come second. For a character to work, Aristotle wrote, four aspects must be developed. Before I get into those, it's worth saying here that although human nature itself hasn't changed much in the last 2,500 years, our understanding of it has undergone a vast shift. Some of our understanding of human nature is certainly simple cultural bias, but you cannot deny that we have made massive inroads into understanding just how the mind works, how personalities are formed, how childhood experiences shape adults, the effect of trauma and deprivation on developing minds, and many, many other factors that were either unknown or considered unimportant before the age of psychoanalysis, which is to say about 99.9% of human history. All of this plays a role in how modern writers develop characters. And yet, once again, Aristotle amazes me with his ability to get right to the heart of what makes a well-rounded character, even though he got some things wrong. First, he says, your character must be good. It seems to me that Aristotle really did mean morally superior here. We understand now that purely virtuous characters in fiction are decidedly one-dimensional and boring. But I interpret this to mean not that your character is a nun or a Girl Scout, but that she possesses some innate redeeming quality that wins the respect of your readers. We also call this being sympathetic or empathetic, meaning it's possible for us to feel right along with her as she undergoes whatever happens to her in the story. Aristotle probably would have considered Zog to be a morally superior character, because he's putting the future of his people above his own personal safety. Second, your character must be appropriate, which I interpret to mean that her various qualities must make sense based on her identity. Again, Aristotle believes that some people are naturally superior to others, and so here again, we have to part ways with him. He did not think it was possible for the character of a slave or a woman to display the same type of virtues as a freeborn man, for example, and we know now that this is just plain wrong. But I define appropriate in a different way. Your character needs to behave in a way that makes sense for that individual, given all that you know about their background and circumstances, and I don't think Aristotle would have disagreed with that. The third quality is that she must be believable or plausible, depending on your translation. Aristotle leaves this curiously undefined. He merely says that it's something different from being good and appropriate. I take it to mean that we have to believe this person could, in theory, exist, even though we know it's a work of the imagination. But this seems to me a curiously awkward way of explaining character development, and it's yet another thing that convinces me Aristotle was not a playwright himself, for what he describes as plausibility is what I interpret to mean our ability to believe that this person is real, even though we know he is imaginary. The fourth quality is consistency, which he also does a very poor job of explaining. They need to behave according to their personality throughout the story. Would I, as a novelist writing in the modern age, add anything to these four qualities, or would other authors? In addition to characters being sympathetic and engaging, we talk a lot these days about character development. That is how a character changes over the course of a story. Aristotle doesn't touch explicitly on that, but it does seem to me that when he talks about reversals and discoveries, he anticipates that the events of the story need to have a major impact on the character's thought and action. In fact, using these terms makes more sense to me than talking about character development, which as a young writer always seemed to me to be a confusing and vague term. In crass terms, you can keep your readers hooked by making use of reversals. Aristotle called them peripeties, which happen when things in your story change from one state to its opposite. By discoveries, Aristotle meant those moments when your hero learns something, either about himself or one of the other characters, which has an impact on the direction of the story. We might think of these today as simple plot twists, but there is really nothing simple about plot twists, at least not when done well. They are at their most effective when they fulfill a certain set of expectations. The finest form of discovery is attended by peripety, he wrote. In other words, it's most satisfying to your readers when a reversal arises directly out of a discovery. Here's one example from a play that most of us had to read in high school, and which is contemporary with Aristotle himself, Oedipus the King. When Oedipus learns that the woman he'd recently slept with was his mother, a discovery, this is the cause of his reversal from happiness to misery. This new state in turn leads to his eventual self-mutilation and exile, so this is how his discovery has an impact on the direction of the story. Imagine how much less effective the story of Oedipus the King, which Aristotle considered the finest tragedy ever written, would have been had the hero never learned the truth about his mother. Or imagine if his blindness had arisen from some other cause, a war or a disease. Would those elements of the story still have the same dramatic impact if one did not come from the other? Absolutely not. And now we have a better understanding of why. Let's think like writers now and try to add both a reversal and a discovery to Zog's story of how he hunted the mammoth. This is going to be hard because story elements don't fit together neatly like Lego pieces. You can't just pop them in or out so easily. It's more like ripping a design out of a quilt and sewing a new one in its place. Everything is interwoven and may pull on the warp or weft in ways you didn't anticipate. We need to bring new elements into the story in order to make this happen. So let's start with the discovery, which should then lead to the reversal. As we said earlier, nobody wants to read a story about people who are happy because they got what they wanted, at least not without watching them struggle for it. This again is all about conflict. The simplest and most engaging way to figure out how to improve a story, once again, is to ask yourself whether your proposed idea adds anything to the overall level of conflict in the story. Where does the idea itself come from? That I can't help you with. You need to get your own juices flowing, perform your own dark rituals, put in your own keyboard time before that can come. My ideas could easily ruin your story, and vice versa. But let's look at the bear plot for a moment. Zog wants that mammoth so he can feed his tribe. That's what Kurt Vonnegut would call his glass of water. The stakes really couldn't be higher. If he doesn't get that mammoth, his people will starve. So if we want to add a discovery to the story, ideally it would come in the form of some sort of conflict that serves to hinder or prevent him from accomplishing his goal. I propose that we add another character, another hunter from another tribe, a stranger. He appears out of nowhere one day, standing on a distant hilltop, leaning on his spear, looking down over the valley where the mammoth herd is peacefully grazing, unaware of the human drama about to unfold above them. This new hunter doesn't know Zog is there yet. He thinks he has the valley to himself, and he thinks he's going to be the one to get that mammoth. He doesn't look right to Zog. The designs on his clothing are different. He wears his hair and beard differently somehow. He smells strange, even from 100 yards away. Exploring all these details and fleshing them out on the page would be an important part of character development. For example, exactly how does he smell? Describe this in a way you haven't read before. Avoid vague, nondescriptive words like strange or bad or different. Get specific with a simile. He smelled like rotten meat. Or use a metaphor. His smell was a porcupine quill in Zog's nostrils, painful and violent. So we have already experienced a bit of a reversal. If Zog was feeling confident about his chances of getting the mammoth, Suddenly, he's feeling anxious and possibly angry about the sudden appearance of this strange hunter. He's anticipating a fight, but this isn't the main reversal. The hunter simply appearing is not in itself a discovery, because this hasn't yet led to Zog learning anything about him or himself. To keep things simple, let's say that the discovery we're after here is Zog's identification of the hunter. That's it. Once he figures out who the guy is, this is what determines what happens next. So what is a discovery exactly? Aristotle broke discovery down into six stages or levels, each one better than the last. The first and lowest kind is identification by signs and tokens, including congenital marks, such as a lightning-shaped scar on the forehead. Apologies to Harry Potter fans. So if Zog were to suddenly recognize this hunter by some sort of outward physical mark like this, and realize that he is, for example, actually a distant relative, which would be a positive and therefore rather boring development, or possibly a warrior he's heard of who murdered Zog's own father years earlier, which would certainly make things much more interesting. Recognizing this strange hunter by means of something external like this would be the weakest way for the author to do it. The next best way is identification by the author, by which Aristotle means when the author causes characters to reveal themselves. The modern term for this is sending telegrams. The new hunter spots Zog and yells across the valley, "I'm the guy who killed your father, and now I'm coming for you." No building conflict, nothing interesting revealed, just a telegram from the author who got lazy and decided to phone it in. Better than the lightning-shaped scar on the forehead, but still not very good. Third is identification through memory, when the main character suddenly recalls something that changes the course of the story. Let's posit that Zog was actually present when his father was murdered, and he suddenly remembers having seen this hunter before, years ago, when he was just a young boy. And there's triggered in him a whole slew of memories. He says to himself, "Oh yeah, that's the guy who killed my dad." Getting better, but still pretty weak in terms of story. Fourth is identification by inference. Let's change things so that Zog wasn't present when his father died, but he has heard stories about the man who killed him. Let's say that according to eyewitness accounts, he had a red beard and green eyes, or he wore a headpiece made from a wolf's skull. And this strange new hunter matches this description, so he can infer that this is the man who killed his father. Fifth is a complicated kind of discovery, which Aristotle says is based on fallacious reasoning by the audience. He offers the convoluted example of a play called Odysseus, the False Messenger, in which the poet tells us that Odysseus alone can bend a certain bow, but Odysseus himself tells us that he will recognize the bow that he has never seen. The discovery, which in this case is simply the identification of the bow, actually arises out of the former, while the audience believes it arises out of the latter. Two different premises delivered to the audience, one from the author, one from the main character himself, only one of which informs the plot of the story, the other of which misleads the audience, but not in the good way a red herring might. It's a strange example, and frankly, not very useful. The sixth and best kind of discovery, which is the kind of discovery we ought to be striving for, since we want our story to be a bestseller and get turned into a movie starring Matthew McConaughey and Jennifer Lawrence, arises from the natural course of events within the story. Since this is the best and most satisfying kind of discovery, it's also the hardest to achieve. Aristotle tells us that emotional impact is delivered through a probable sequence. As an example, again, we'll look at Sophocles' Oedipus the King, which in those days was just called Oedipus. To remind you, prior to the beginning of that story, Oedipus had become king of Thebes while unwittingly fulfilling a prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother. The thing that he wants, Kurt Vonnegut's glass of water, is to find the killer of his father, but of course he's unaware that person is himself. The truth comes to light. Jocasta kills herself out of shame, and Oedipus gouges out his own eyes. It's a brilliant story, the finest example of tragedy, and as such, it is absolutely worth ripping off in the most shameless fashion. There is a quote variously attributed to Picasso, Faulkner, and Igor Stravinsky that says, "Good artists imitate while great artists steal." We want to be great artists, so let's just steal it. In order to do that, we would simply rewrite our story. Maybe the strange hunter actually is Zog's father, who he has believed all this time is dead. They fight, Zog wins, his father dies, he kidnaps the man's widow and brings her back to the village along with the mammoth meat. How he carries all that mammoth meat, I have no idea. We'd have to sort that out somehow. And then later learns the truth that the man was his father and his new wife is his own mother, and he gouges out his own eyes. So, the discovery leads to the reversal and not the other way around. Despite my facetious example, this really is how the best tragedies are constructed. And because the modern novel, again, is most like tragedy, I think this is how the best novels can be written too. And finally, I'd like to turn to the question of why. Why do we write fiction? Why do so many people have this desire? What is it fulfilling? What is its purpose? Here is what Aristotle tells us. Two things, both of them natural, seem likely to have been the causes of the origin of poetry. Representation comes naturally to human beings from childhood, and so does the universal pleasure in representations. Indeed, this marks off humans from other animals. Man is prone to representation beyond all others, and learns his earliest representations from them. A common phenomenon is evidence of this, even when things are painful to look upon. Corpses, for instance, or the shape of the most revolting animals. We take pleasure in viewing highly realistic images of them. The further explanation of this is that learning is delightful, not only to philosophers, but to ordinary people as well, even though they have less capacity for it. End quote. So Aristotle seems to be saying here that the real reason we enjoy representations, in which we might include novels as well as plays, is that we learn from them, even though we are a bit simple. This fits with the notion which I stated earlier that storytelling is really an efficient method of conveying information vital to our survival somehow. This would imply that writers are in fact teachers rather than entertainers. Aristotle's explanation also fits with the work of Yuval Harari, historian and author of the fascinating work Sapiens. In Sapiens, Harari says that storytelling is in our very DNA. We couldn't stop even if we wanted to. It would literally kill us. Harari says, telling effective stories is not easy. The difficulty lies not in telling the story, but in convincing everyone else to believe it. So how are we, the audience, able to believe something we know very well isn't true? What is the suspension of disbelief? How does it work? Why do we do it? The ability to create an imagined reality out of words enabled large numbers of strangers to cooperate effectively, Harari says. Civilization itself arose from the fact that we tell each other stories. And most of those stories are not the rarefied type of legends that endure over millennia, such as myths, but are far more mundane, like gossip. According to Harari, our language evolved as a way of gossiping. Harari sees gossip as absolutely critical to the bonds of any social group and points out that when history professors get together for lunch, they don't talk about the root causes of World War I, but rather who in the department is sleeping with whom, or, quote, the quarrel between the head of the department and the dean, or the rumors that a colleague used his research funds to buy a Lexus, unquote. Gossips, not hunters, were the first storytellers. So what is the real role of the storyteller then? What is the nature of the person who appoints herself a teller of tales? Writers are often observers of other people. At parties, we stand in the corner, pretending to study or actually studying the spines of books on the shelves, meanwhile paying attention out of the corners of our eyes to how other members of our species are laughing, chattering, drinking, and otherwise socializing. All of this is being recorded and may very well emerge somehow in fictionalized form. We know the people in the stories we read aren't real, but we understand also that they are creations that took reality as its raw material. People like these could have existed and might well exist. Therefore, we should pay attention to see what they do and how they overcome the various kinds of conflict they encounter in case we ourselves ever come across something similar. That way, we'll know what to do. This can be even more abstract. We delight in tales of things that happened centuries ago, describing situations that could never come to pass today because we still have something to learn about the spirit that can endure deprivations we can't even imagine experiencing ourselves, for example. In my own most recent book, I retell the story of my great-grandmother's passage from a rural 19th century Polish village to the America of the early 20th century. This story has never failed to enthrall me, even though I know how it ends. And it has resonated with many readers who leave comments on the book's Amazon page telling me how similar it is to their own family history. Why would we as a species do that? Why do we enjoy hearing some stories over and over? And why does it thrill us when we encounter stories similar to our own? I believe these questions and many others like it have been beautifully addressed by Harari and other thinkers and sociologists. And I think Aristotle might well have been satisfied with the answers. Very simply, we are not just animals who happen to enjoy telling stories. We are storytelling animals. We need stories to survive. Without them, we die. Sometimes figuratively, sometimes literally. One more quote from Harari for you. Planet Earth was conquered by Homo sapiens rather than by chimpanzees or elephants because we are the only mammals that can cooperate in very large numbers. And large-scale cooperation depends on believing common stories. But these stories need not be true. You can unite millions of people by making them believe in completely fictional stories about God, about race, or about economics. So our ability to tell stories does more than help our tribe survive or keep them entertained. Stories are the pillar of fire in the night leading us through the desert. They shape history and our world and our very future. They can destroy as well as create. The stories we tell can be awful as well as beautiful. Their truth or untruth is completely irrelevant. It matters only if people agree to believe them. Now, what are we supposed to do with all this information? How should the hopeful writer take everything I've talked about tonight and use it to create her magnum opus? The main issue I have with works on how to write fiction is that they are, by their very nature, analytical. But I have found writing fiction to be a decidedly non-analytical process. It is instead an intuitive one for me, and that has always been the integral part of the practice for me. I think I do my best work when I write by discovery. Here I don't mean the same kind of discovery we were just talking about, but instead just feeling my way along in the dark, discovering things, or more precisely, inventing them, and then deciding whether they represent directions that are worth pursuing, or if they are just another one of the many false leads that seek to beguile the novelist who is enthralled with his own voice. So how should we do it in this day and age? How can we create a perfect plot that uses the highest form of discovery to create a tale of great emotional impact? Phrased in other terms, how seriously should we take Aristotle's advice? I would say that poetics is absolutely worth reading and discussing in depth once. Read it thoroughly, master the principles Aristotle lays out, absorb them into your psyche, and then, in the immortal words of Donnie Brasco, forget about it. Don't use it or any other book on writing as a manual. Use it as a launching pad. I do not believe you can create authentic, meaningful fiction by following rules. Here's one simple dictum I lay out for hopeful writers of all ages and backgrounds. When you break the rules out of ignorance, that's amateurism. When you break them on purpose, that's style. Thank you very much for your attention. I wish you a pleasant evening.